Birshus, Arabanim, board members, honored guests, my in-laws. First, I would just like to thank the Rabbi Price Foundation for its kind and generous support of the Beit Midrash over the years. It is much appreciated. And we hope we are following in the... I do this every time I have to speak. We hope we follow in the legacy of Rabbi Price here in Toronto. You know, it's difficult to give a memorial lecture, especially when you didn't know somebody personally. You know, it wasn't just that I didn't live in Toronto when Rabbi Price was active, but he passed away when I was six. So even if I had lived in Toronto, I assume I would not have appreciated his legacy. But through talking to his students and reading his writings, I've come, I hope, to understand a bit of his personality, his unique approach to Torah, which I want to explore a bit tonight. Do it. You don't need to do it professionally, but you do it anyways. The love that you have for the game, so to speak, is all the more evident. And as I read through Rabbi Price's writings, trying to figure out what I was going to say, that's what I felt. Someone who was into Torah because he loved it. And he wrote about what he wanted to write about, and he said what he wanted to say, and he thought what he wanted to think because he did this because he loved it, not because he needed to. Besides for in the sense of an inner compulsion. And there's something beautiful about that. And when you read through somebody's works, and that comes out, both in their homiletics, in their drashot, and in their lamdus, in their analytical treatments of some of the more obscure svarim in the Jewish library, that's quite a testament to the power of the personality behind those words. So I wanted to try to figure out, how am I going to speak about this giant? How am I going to get a feel for who he was and be true to his Torah? So, I'm a big fan of trying to see what did people think of themselves. If you want to understand somebody, you have to see what they thought of themselves. And the best way to see what someone thinks of themselves is to read Hakdama, is to read introductions to Svarim. Because good Hakdamot, good introductions require an author to, for a moment, be self-aware, to step back and look at what he's written, look at the life he or she has lived, and try to explain why it is that they did what they did and what were they trying to do. So, I sat and read through Hakdamot, because the truth is I'd been exposed to his writing before and I had certain intuitions about what it was he was out to do and what type of person he was from what I'd read. And I here acknowledge Sam and thank Sam for giving me some of the not yet published portions of Rabbi Price's final Sefer on the Smog, which means that I guess, even though I didn't know him personally, I know some things that most people here, even who did know him, haven't read yet. So I thank you for that. It gives me an upper hand. Even though I really did want to integrate it, but I just didn't know how to give a shiur in 40 minutes on Hilchos Kilai Begadim. It's a bit of a challenge, so I went not that way. So I started reading through his Hakdamot. And reading through different pieces in his Svarim. And the first thing that came to mind, which I then had to quickly backtrack on, but I want to tell you what I thought first, was the following chakira, the following analysis, not in Torah, but in life. Several years ago, Moshe Lichtenstein, the son of my late teacher, Aaron Lichtenstein, also a teacher of mine, was giving a shiur in memory of his father. Now, his father published many, many articles in his life, but very few svarim in his life. He had many svarim with his Torah in it, but he didn't publish most of them himself. They were Kovet Shire, they were Shire Haral, Shire Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, published by his students. But Rav Moshe argued that this wasn't just a fluke, but this was actually a sign of the times. And he said, imagine for a moment you lived 200 or 300 years ago. Who were the major rabbinic figures 300 years ago? 200 years ago. So I picked a few examples out of a hat. The Noda Behuda, Rabbi Chezkel Landa. Chezkel Landa was the basically unargued leader of his time. You can tell this by looking at the Haskamot on Svarim. Everyone else gets Harav HaGaon, the rabbi, the genius, and he gets Harav HaGaon Mofet Yisrael Nasi Hador. Right? The Mofet Hador, the wonder of the generation, the prince of Israel. But he was the rabbi, before he became the rabbi in Prague, he was the rabbi in Yampol. He was the rabbi in some shtetl out in the middle of nowhere. And yet, he was the recognized Gadol Hador that he could weigh in on the machloket between Yaakov Emdin and Yodin son Eibschitz, even while he was the Rav, off in this little shtetl. Jump to the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Some of the best known Svarim, Rochanan Wasserman, Kovet Shiurim, Rav Gusman, Kuntres Shiurim. What's the difference between these types of leaders? So Rav Moshe said, the Noda Behuda was living in an era where the yeshiva system was still being built, and therefore you had many rabbanim who had the entirety of their creative enterprise was expressed in writing. Because their rabbinic duties were to be the rav of some small shtetl. How intellectually taxing was it? So how did they express their creativity in Torah that was just overflowing from them? They wrote. So the Noda Behuda, writing in the middle of nowhere, writes the Noda Behuda, writes the Tzlach. But then, as the yeshivot grew, and the more dominant figures in the rabbinic community, and again, this is an overgeneralization, but many of the leading figures became Rashi Yeshiva, whose role in life was teaching, suddenly, writing wasn't the expression of its, in and of itself, it captured their teaching, because their life was about their students, and their writing reflected their interaction with people day to day. So you have Kovet Shiurim, which is literally just a collection of the Shiurim Rav Elchanan gave. You have Kuntres Shiurim, which is Rav Gushman committing his Shiurim to write it. But there were exceptions in the 20th century, some notable ones. I'll take two. Rav Pinchas Kahati, who was a banker, not a teacher, but he wrote his monumental commentary on Mishnah, and Rav Yeruch Official Perla, who write his magnificent commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvot of Rav Sadia Gaon. Because again, he was a professional. He wrote for fun. And it makes sense, because they were, let's say, a throwback to the old model. They weren't professional teachers. They were in it for the love of the game, as Reb Lichtenstein used to say. Right? They were in it, he liked to use sports metaphors. He was in it for the love of the game. So I knew that Rabbi Price was a self-made businessman. He was in it for the love of the game. And you read the Smag, his Perush on the Smag, and you read his Perush on Sefer Hasidim, and you read its Chidushim in Mishnas Avram, and you know that he can't have expected huge throngs of people to be pouring through every last detail of his Chidushim on the Smag, because they wouldn't understand it. It takes a serious Talmud Chacham to understand what he's doing in these books. But he loves it. You can tell he loves it. He's having so much fun. Mi inyan li inyan, vo so inyan. He goes from one topic to the next topic. You see, he's just sitting there having fun. And I said, you know what? It makes sense. He was in it because he wanted to be. And he's expressing himself most creatively in writing. But on the other hand, I knew that this wasn't the full story. Because I had first become exposed to him through his students. And I knew that he was also a very active teacher, a shul rabbi. And a very big part of his life was not buried in the pages of his books, but was in real life. So I tried to figure out, right, was my original intuition right or wrong? And then I kept reading, and I realized that Rabbi Price recognized this chakira in life, applied it to himself, and half confirmed my thesis, but clarified the rest of who he was from his own perspective. And what I found was someone who was very attuned to the very different styles in which Torah can be taught, and understood the power of those different styles, and his insight into the power of language, the modes of learning, the importance of rhetoric, wasn't just a testament to who he was as a leader, but actually led to new insights into Torah itself. And that's what I want to explore with you today. So what I'm going to take you through is his writing. Now, I don't like retyping things, so it was good that I also thought it felt more authentic to actually just cut and paste from his book. So you can see his svarim. We can feel like we're learning his Torah. The translation is mine. So the first hakdama, which I found very telling, is from the second volume of Imrei Avram, from his drashot, his homiletics. And he writes as follows. Ha'ichur shel 28 shana shebein hadpasat ha'chelek ha'sheni v'ha'chelek ha'rishon b'sifri zeh. There was 28 years between the publication of volume 1 and 2 of my drashot. He said, why? Why did I wait 28 years? I can't even imagine that. That is almost my entire life. Okay, almost my entire life. 28 years ago, I wasn't 2 yet, so, right? Why did I wait 28 years? So he said, first of all, first of all, I was busy. It's because I was busy. But what was I busy with? Shayiti tarud v'asuk b'sidur sifrei halacha sheli. I was busy writing halachic svarim. Shemehem Todah, right, sorry, I took me a minute when I first did it, right? Todah, thank God, Hoteti Lor, I published. Sefer Mishnah Avraham, Chelek Bet, Sefer Chasidim, Shlosha Chalakim, Smar Chelek Aleph, Imperushi, Uveiri, Mishnah Avraham, right? My Svarim on Shas, Sefer Chasidim, the Smag, Shizachiti Bezrat, which I had the privilege to publish after the current work. But then he explains why did I do it in this order? There are many different reasons why you might focus on your halachic writing. Why would you focus on your halachic writing? And the answer he gave surprised me. The first answer didn't surprise me. But he said, why? Why did I give precedence to my halachic words over the homiletic ones? First of all, I like halacha more. Okay, that I expected. But I got that. He was a classic lamdan. Lamdanim like Torah. They like halacha. Drashot. Okay, drashot. You know, classic lamdanim. They like Lumdus more than like Drasha. That I expected. Kamram, and then he quotes the Gemara Rashana, Aidi de Chaviva le Akhname Beresha, since it was beloved to him, he put it first. No saf al zeh. But then he said something very surprising. Lo akhed she yoter kal venoachli, lichtov divrei halacha, measher lachin litfus divrei drush. I also think that it's easier to write halacha and lumdus, theoretical complex analysis, than it is to write homiletics, drasha. Now this is surprising, because you go to a svarim store, right? Many people publish their drasha. Right? They publish their vorts on parsha. They write down their drasha. The svarim stores are filled with it. Less people are capable of sitting down and writing an in-depth analysis of a sugya or a halachic issue. So what does it mean? It's easier for me. I haven't written a sefer, but I've written many a divrei Torah. Right? When I write a halachic article, it takes me weeks. When I write a parsha article, it takes me an hour. Right? And that's only because I need to make sure to check the grammar so that Rabbi Turchiner then doesn't criticize my grammar. Right? big deal, right? What do you mean it's easier to write your halachic works? So he writes, because there's a fundamental difference between halachic writing and homiletics and drasha. When you write a halachic work, you can write as long as you want. You can write whatever you want so that people will understand you. Because the person who's sitting down to read a deep analytical piece, he's already, hopefully, in the sugya, as they say. He's already involved. He's hopefully bothered by the same questions you are. And therefore, he understands the context. So if you write it a little bit less midiyak, a little bit less carefully, a little bit more carefully, you're a little bit more verbose, you're a little bit less verbose, you reference a Rambam and tell them to look it up, they'll figure it out. They're in it with you. But not homiletics, not when you're giving a drasha. You have to be very careful how you say things. Why? Because it's not just what you say, it's what you emphasize. And when you're giving a drasha, you don't want people to walk away. Right? If you're trying to get at people's hearts, you want them to walk away with the right emphasis. Right? You don't want them to... I don't want you to walk away today and think that the primary point of my speech was when I said, you know, Birshud HaRabbanim. Right? Look, he thinks it's important to ask permission before he starts speaking. Right? That's not the main content of what I'm saying. Right? You don't want... But when... You're giving a drasha. He says, why? Can they show and he said, speaking, preaching, giving a drasha is not like writing. But tafash would be dibur. When you're speaking, you can raise your voice, lower your voice, gesticulate, move your hands. Right? People, it's a whole experience. But if you try to convey that to writing, it doesn't work. It's very hard. It's very hard to be a gifted enough writer that you can get across your emphasis, your emotional connection to what you're saying, the way you can in person. And therefore, to get that idea that is part of the whole drasha, you can't write it quickly. It's slow. It's slow and tedious work. Share lo. Groch milim tuyaz varat harayon. El bimaat milim. Right? It's not by saying more words. Right? Brevity is the soul of wit. In lamdus, you can keep writing, it'll be clearer. If you want to get at somebody's heart, you've got to be brief, to the point, and powerful. Bilvad shakotiv yichtoved anivim eruyim anechonim. And you have to say exactly the right expression. Right? Think about it. Right, think about it. What are the things that move us? A line here. Right? We're listening to a drasha and there's one beautifully crafted phrase that just resonates with us. And 50 years later, that's the line you remember. Because when you're trying to get at somebody's heart, you've got to be so much more careful in how you write. And homiletics, giving a drasha, where it isn't about just getting people to understand the sugya, someone who's already in it, but you're trying to tug at somebody. You're trying to emphasize something. It's an art. It's an art of writing. And this, I think, is a very sharp chakira in life. Like, you would think that it's easier to write drasha, to write inspiration. But Rabbi Price recognized that's not how human nature is. When you write halachic literature, you may have a smaller audience, but the audience you have is a captive one. Because they're learning the sugya, they're interested in what you have to say. So you write a little bit less clearly, a little bit more clearly. They're in it with you. But if you're trying to inspire people, by definition, you're speaking to people who aren't yet with you. That's the point. So you have to be pithy, you have to be brief, you have to be sharp, you have to be powerful. You have to be able to inspire. And that is hard. And therefore, even if the content of halachic writing is more difficult, more taxing on the mind, the art of writing is in many ways easier. And then I started to realize that my hakira in life was sort of right with Rabbi Price. Because what is he telling you? His halachic writing isn't meant for everybody. It's meant for people who want to open up and learn the sugya. It's meant for the people who are his intellectual peers, who've decided of their own accord to enter into his world. So he says, that's easy for me. That's easy. I love chidushim, as we'll see. I love chidushim. But if you already come to my conversation, it's easy for me to write. You're already with me. That's the, as I said at the beginning, that's the Nodi Bihuda model. That's the person who could just as easily be off in Yampol, right? Off in some shtetl somewhere, writing his chidushim, knowing that there'll be somebody somewhere who'll read his book, and who'll be his virtual chavrusa. And just like with your chavrusa, you don't plan what you're going to say before. You just get into the heart of it, and you start talking, and you start thinking, and you start learning, and you're just in the game, and they're playing with you. He'll do that in a sefer. But then he tells you there was a second part to his personality. And that was the part of him that recognized that you also need to reach people who aren't with you yet. Who can't or won't open up your halachic svarim. Who you need to inspire. And doing that is ironically much more difficult. And from what I've heard from his life, those were the two parts of his personality. The prodigy who knew that there were only X number of people in the entire world who would understand his chidushim. But he wrote it for those people because he loved it. I did the chaviv alei. I just love it. I can sit there and I can write and I can have a virtual chavrusa with whoever feels like joining me. But then there was the communal leader who said, but you know what? There are people beyond that who I need to reach. I need to inspire. And that is so hard. That's the harder one. It's not as intellectually taxing. But in a fundamental sense, it's much more difficult to get an audience who isn't already captive. To be able to do that, that's a skill. That's amazingly difficult. And if you manage to do it and to inspire, and as we see from the number of people who are here, 24 years after he passed away, he was successful. That's incredible. If you continue to three, though, I found it beautiful to see how he described, as I said, that virtual chavrusa in his lamdish svarim. This is what he writes in his Hakdamah Mishnas Avraham. What is this? He's describing himself, his own writing, his novelties. Yesh kan sicha aruka achat shel talmid ashoge mishna asho ne mishnato u'mifalpel mitoch kach menyan le'enyan v'steif memenu. There's one long conversation between a student engrossed in his studies, analyzing one thing, whatever it leads to. Sometimes he writes lengthy from something far away. He compares things. Hagam shemi sugim shonim, even though they're different. The kachi darka shel Torah. That's the Torah. Kol haTorah kula dimuyim midaminan la. All of Torah is just comparison. Is stream of consciousness. We go from one issue to the next because we love it. We live it. We just roll with it. So when he's writing his chidushim, he says that. That's my halachic svarim. Right? As I sort of intuited, his halachic svarim, he viewed himself in that model of the Nodi Bihuda, the person who was having a virtual with chavrusa, with whoever felt like opening up his book. In the Hakdama to Mishnas Avraham 2, and everyone told me he was a personality to know. Hakdama to Mishnas Avraham 2 is fascinating. Because after giving his Akdama, he decides he has a biting critique of the state of philanthropy. It's a very interesting piece. He says, look, I'm not saying that Jews are not generous. They are. Jews are very generous. But I have a taina on them. Because Jews, it's very hard to get them to support chidushim. Because they don't appreciate them. And then he goes on, he says, you know what I hate the most? These people who pour their life into writing These beautiful pearls of Torah. They send their sefer out asking for support. Someone gets it in the mail, never reads the book, puts it on their shelf, doesn't bother sending a check to help them support, doesn't bother sending back the book, right? Because they don't appreciate what a chiddush is. But what do you see? In the middle of that vitriol, right? And he's quite harsh with these people, right? He tries to balance it with saying, they're really generous, but they don't get it, is a recognition. On the one hand, the most important thing for me is chidushim. Torah is all about contributing, adding your novelty. I wish more people appreciated it, but I recognize that's not realistically where people are. And you come back to his Akdam on the Drasha and you realize, right, he understood human nature, and that affected how he taught, how he lived, how he inspired. He knew where people were and where they weren't. He might have hoped they were somewhere else. He might have hoped that the average person would pick up a chiddush within his chidushim on the Sefer Chassidim, but he knows that's not where people are. He wished people would at least appreciate what they're missing, but he knows people aren't that way either. But again, you see that recognition of, on the one hand, what's most important to him personally, right? He is this Mayan HaMitgaber. He's just overflowing with chidushim that he wants to write, he wants to share with whoever will come and be his virtual Chavrusa. But he knows that you can't end with feeling fulfilled because you've written your chidushim for the few people who are going to read it, knowing that not everyone's going to read it, knowing not everyone appreciates it. And therefore you need to find it in yourself to also be who the people need you to be, and to write the way people need you to write. And it takes a real Adam Gadol to recognize both. To say, I wish I could just sit and write chidushim, and that everyone would appreciate it, and sometimes be annoyed that not everyone does. But then to recognize, but if they're not there yet, then I've got to be someone else for them. And I've got to build the yeshiva, and I've got to teach people who are going to university and need a few hours of learning. And what I hear from all his students, he was, on the one hand, this prodigy who people couldn't necessarily ever hope to be as smart as him and understand every last chiddush, but on the other hand, someone who was there for the people who needed him and could be more than one thing at the same time. But he was self-aware. He was aware that that's what he was doing. So far I've only talked about his personality, but what struck me, and this is the testament to a serious Talmud Chacham, is when your insights in Torah affect your perception of life, of human nature, and your perceptions of human nature affect your chidushim in Torah. It's the sign of someone who is integrated. And what was amazing is that this insight into the different ways people write, and audience, and the importance of that led to chidushim in Torah, which you don't always expect. Right? You have someone who's he's a mechadesh, maybe he's also a good leader, but sometimes you see people, they're brilliant leaders of communities. They're maybe even brilliant mechadshim. But then you read their svarim, and you don't see evidence of their brilliance in human nature in their chidushim. Lokarav zel zeh, they're distinct disciplines. But as I read more, I realized that his insights into human nature affected how he understood Torah and gave him insights someone else might not have had. So you look at number 5. This is from his Akdamah to Sefer Chassidim, Volume 1. And he's explaining, why is it that no one ever wrote on the Sefer Chassidim? Well, why do people not really write on it? There aren't so many commentaries on Sefer Chassidim. Okay, there aren't so many, trust me. Right, Rabbi Price is almost definitely, I haven't checked, but is probably the most thorough Perush ever written on Sefer Chassidim. So he said, why didn't people write this masterful work? Why? So just look at the English. I didn't translate everything. I gave it to you here, but I translate only a key few lines. It says, the reason for the lack of commentaries and explanations of Sefer Chassidim are, in my opinion, the following. In all generations, Jewish scholars have not held back from using it. Look, people always read Sefer Chassidim. And every statement, idea in his book, and ethical will were accepted and sanctified among all strains of the nation. People read his book. They read the Tzava, his ethical will. But here's the problem. Nevertheless, They saw it only as a book of Mussar, good character traits and practices, stories that help bring a person's heart close to his Father in heaven. Only here and there did they derive laws from it. However, in truth, this book is full of halachot. However, because this book is written in a unique style, with no other like it, as the author writes in popular parlance and envelops halacha in it, And he says something fascinating. He says, you know why people didn't write on Sefer Chassidim? Because people expect halachic writing to be dense and impenetrable. But Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, according to Rabbi Price, no. He knew that it was possible sometimes to say things that were concrete halachot in a way that the average person could pick it up. It's a skill. It's very hard. And what does he tell you? He says the average Rav thinks that if you can understand a piece of writing, that it must not be halachic. Because in order for it to be, if it's real serious halacha, it's got to be impenetrable. It's got to be hard. It's got to be... And they can't imagine that you could ever formulate halacha b'lashon amami, in popular parlance, in a way that the average person can understand. And they're so biased by the ease with which Sefer Chassidim writes that they didn't realize it's halacha. And therefore, I sat down and I'm going to prove it's halacha. But what do you see here? You see something very interesting. What led to his conviction that Sefer Chassidim is a Sefer Halacha and not just a Sefer Mussar? Because he recognizes the power of rhetoric. He recognizes the power of the use of language. And therefore he says the average person doesn't realize that you could be really skilled and write halacha for the Hamonam. But I do, because I have thought about what language is trying to accomplish. I've thought about it. I understand that usually halachic writing, as he says about himself, halachic writing can be flowing, can be a virtual chavrusa. And that when things are formulated carefully, often that's because people were just trying to inspire and not to paskin. But I also recognize that it doesn't have to be that way. Because once you recognize that there's importance to the discipline of rhetoric, you're able to distinguish between style and content. And recognize that perhaps there are people who broke the normal mode, the normal model. And therefore he looked at Sefer Chassidim and said, not, it's easy to read, it must not be halacha, but he said, wow, look, there's someone who managed to take what's normally not accessible to the average person, but was a master rhetorician. And I'm going to revive it, because, as he says about himself, that's not how I write. My chidushim, I write for the people who are already initiated. My drasha, my inspiration, I write for the Hamonam. But if I find someone who somehow managed to take halacha and make it accessible, that's who I want to analyze. Because that's his recognition of that interview with Achasid was because he thought carefully about rhetoric. And you see, his understanding of life and human nature led him to a systematic chiddush about the Sefer Chassidim. And just a few lines later, he quotes perhaps one of the most well-known passages in the Sefer Chassidim. Namely, the Sefer Chassidim writes that if there's a mitzvah that no one's performing, or there's a sefer that no one's learning, that becomes a mace mitzvah. And just like we have a special mitzvah to bury someone who has no one to bury them, so we have a special mitzvah to learn that sefer. And I think, even though he implies this, he doesn't spell it out himself, is that that's how he viewed the Sefer Chassidim. He recognized that the average person didn't see what he saw in Sefer Chassidim. And I'm speculating here. He probably also knew that the average person wasn't going to read his many thousands of pages on the Sefer Chassidim. But its very existence would be a testament to what he thought Sefer Chassidim was. And therefore, even if people wouldn't systematically read it, the fact that they knew Harav Agon Rav Price had written on Sefer Chassidim meant that, you know what, maybe there's more to it. And when they were learning that passage, They might bother to look it up. They might not read the whole thing cover to cover. But he was going to recover what he saw as the greatness of Sefer Chasidim, which he only perceived because of his understanding of how rhetoric works. And it goes farther. His recognition of the power of language leads to this incredible introduction to Imrei Avraham, Volume 1. In the first volume of his drashot, he has this schematic, historic, theological analysis of agadata of non-halachic literature since the Tanaitic period through the modern period. It is magnificent. It is magnificent. To know that much Torah, to have embodied that much Torah, be able to speak systematically about what agadata has been through each period in Jewish history and the way people analyzed it, it's amazing. So here I give it to you in 6. And he tells you as follows. He says, "Hadarshanut haitam me'olam chilek chashuv me'od b'safrut shel Torateinu." Homiletics, drashot, have always been an important part of Torah literature. "V'tafsa makom nichbad b'vet midrashot shel Yisrael." It's taken an important place in the Torah of the Jewish people. "Mipnei shebahadrash kavua otzer musari shel Torat Yisrael." You know why? Because the secrets are hidden. The ethics of Torah are hidden in drasha. And then he says something amazing. He says, you know what? What do Chazal say about halacha, about mitzvot? Chazal say that it's meant to improve people's character. And he quotes Chazal who say, what does God, so to speak, speaks and says, what do I care whether you shecht an animal from the front or the back? I don't care. I did it for you. I gave you mitzvot for you. But then, Rabbi Price asks himself, and he said, wait a second. If mitzvot are about changing the person, then what do you do to make sure that people realize that? Because try opening up Shulchan Aruch and understanding right away how that's supposed to change you ethically, religiously, existentially. Good luck. So he says, I got it. He said, you open up the Gemara is not Shulchan Aruch. It's not a code. It's me'inyan le'inyan me'oso inyan. It's from one topic to another. But not just that, it's agadata and halacha intertwined. So we tend to think that just because, you know, that's how they wrote, that's how they thought. He says, that's true. But you know why they thought that way? Because they understood that halacha is meant to change the person. And therefore, if you make a sharp break between halachic literature and agadic literature, people will forget that. So what do? You mix the agadata in. And suddenly his recognition of human nature, his recognition of the purpose of mitzvah, which are to inspire, and his recognition, as we saw at the beginning, that law, written as law, is very hard to inspire the average person, led him to a chiddush into why Shas is written the way it is. Because Chazal were trying to reach that balance that I found so difficult. So on the one hand, write halacha, but on the other hand, inspire. So my solution was to write drashot and halachic works. Chazal's was to write Gemara, which intertwines agadata and halacha. It sounds like a simple point, but to actually think that way, to realize that if Chazal intertwined them, it's because they wanted you to understand they're not distinct. Even though in most people's minds they are distinct, led him to ask what's perhaps a very fundamental question that we don't ask ourselves, which is, if halacha is meant to inspire, why does it always inspire? And the answer is, because we forget the agadata behind the halacha, but Chazal tried not to do that. But his insight into, and these are big chidushim, right? This is his chidush about how Shas was written. But this is not like a little thing, a chiddush in some sugya. This is, how was all of Shas written? Why did Chazal write the way they wrote? And he says, because they understood human nature, and I've learned a lot about human nature from them. I may balance, I may write it differently, I may write my halakhic svarim one way, and my drasha the other way, but I can see godless, I can see the way they wrote. I can see what they were trying to accomplish. And then he goes on. And he pushes back the other way. And he says, but you know what? You can't push too far. Can't push too far. He said, look, I get it. He said, the problem is, once you realize that it's about inspiration, as generations get weaker, the value of inspiration goes up and up and up and up, and the value of halacha goes down and down and down and down. And that's why, he says, you find so many works of drasha nowadays and not so many halachic works. And here again, he's using his analytic mind not just to analyze halacha, but to analyze, not even analyze all of Shas, which is quite a feat, but to analyze Jewish history and the ebb and flow of what literature is giving precedence, halachic or agadic. And he says, you know why you find so much agadata now? Because so much inspiration is needed. And it's so tempting, I'll add, so tempting to only write agadata when you realize people need inspiration. It's so easy to not focus on halacha when you know it won't be appreciated. But that's not who he was, as we saw in his Hakdama before. He recognized the need. He understood why there were other rabbis who were just trying to inspire and weren't writing chiddush after chiddush. But despite the fact he recognized it, he fought to maintain the balance that he understood Chazal themselves had tried. And said, look, I get it. I understand why people are writing more drasha than halacha now. Because they need to inspire. I also write drashot. I also spend the time inspiring. But there's a balance. Never give it up. Never give up the two sides. They're both important. Chazal intertwine them. Don't give up one in favor of the other. And he continues that in 8. And I didn't put this in, but he then also has a little section where he criticizes how everyone else gives drasha and thinks they don't do it carefully enough. They don't think about what they say. They aren't really trying to get at things. And then the last point is that his insight into the melding of these two doesn't just affect how he understands all of Shas and all of Sefer Hasidim. It doesn't just affect the way he writes. It doesn't just affect the way he analyzes history. But now coming back to the little details, it affects how he understands individual sugyot. Because he understands that because Chazal are using different disciplines simultaneously, you can't always take them at face value. And he says, I won't read it inside, but he says, sometimes, because Chazal recognize the power of halacha and the power of agadata, and that they serve different functions, sometimes they write things as if it's a halacha, but it's really just musar. It's derech eretz. And they go so far as to mix things as to actually present inspiration, right, decency, morality, in legal terminology. The Ritva already notes this, that sometimes Chazal say mitzvah, and they don't mean mitzvah. They mean it's a good thing. But for the Ritva, it's a one-liner. But Rabbi Price says, you know why I know, you know what? Let me justify it to you. Let me explain to you why it is that sometimes Chazal mix it. Because he recognized the power of different types of literature. And therefore, and he recognized that what Chazal were trying to do was to mix law and inspiration. So he recognized how they're connected. And therefore he says, you know what justifies, so to speak, the Ritva, claiming that every time it says mitzvah, it doesn't mean mitzvah? Let me give you a whole theory of life behind that. Why is it the Ritva can go through Shas and say that says mitzvah? It means not mitzvah. And sometimes it doesn't say mitzvah and it means mitzvah. Because Chazal are trying to blur the lines. Because they recognize that the two are connected. Right? The Ritva says it in one line, but Rabbi Price, because of his analysis of life, of human nature, of history, of Shas, of Sefer Hasidim, gives a whole systematic understanding of why it is. And he gives one example, that the Gemara, when it tells you the detailed laws of Shomrim, of trust, of entrusting objects to someone, the Gemara tells you that you should, right, if someone gives you money, you should wrap it up in your hand and hold it in your hands. The Gemara says, why do we write this way? To tell you, by the way, it's not about Shomrim, it's just good advice that if you want money to be safe, make sure you have it in your hand, right? Don't put it somewhere else. Why does the Gemara present it in the middle of a detailed sugya about halacha? As if it were halacha. Because that's the point. Chazal are telling you there's many things in life that are important. And just because I'm talking halacha doesn't mean I'm not going to give you some practical advice while I'm here. And if I'm giving you practical advice, I might teach you halacha the next second. And I might frame it as halacha, because then you'll take me seriously, or because we're in the middle of a halachic discussion. But recognize that Chazal themselves understood the power of oration, the power of rhetoric, the power of framing. And use that to interpret their words. So now, just to wrap it up, what I found as I was going through Rabbi Price was somebody who had such a mastery, not just of halacha and agadata and the obscure svarim on the halachic on the halachic bookshelf, but of history, of human nature. But he integrated them, and he understood the power of different modes of speech. He used them in his writing. He wrote his halachic svarim as a personal chavrusa, so whoever would read it. He wrote his drashot to inspire the uninitiated. But it didn't stop there. His insight into those different types of people and the different parts of human nature led him to understand, you know what? The Sefer Hasidim was too good at doing what he meant to do. He made halacha readable, and that's why people didn't understand what it was. You know what? I'm going to revive it. I'm going to make sure that people realize he was just a brilliant writer, but he was no less the halachist. It led him to an insight. This is what Shas is. Shas is the attempt to remind you that halacha and agada, inspiration and law, are not two different disciplines. And it led him to local interpretations, to recognize that, you know why Chazal sometimes frame halachot as non-halachot and non-halachot as halachot? Because they're trying to blur the lines, to touch every aspect of humanity, which is not an easy thing to do. And that, I think, is such what you see emerging from his personality, is someone whose understanding of life, history, human nature, and Torah were so integrated that they influenced each other, and what emerged was this holistic, beautiful exposition on life, on Torah, on history, on human nature, which we can only take inspiration and try to apply to our own lives and integrate the complexity of all human experience in Torah, so that we will follow in his legacy and be as inspired and committed Jews as we can.